Hello, everybody. Welcome to a big one. Some might say the big one. This is episode 100 of Cinescope. I am so excited to be here. It's a long time coming because technically speaking, we should have hit episode 100 a couple years ago at this point. But hey, I'm not here to complain. I'm here to celebrate. And here to celebrate with me is my good friend and frequent guest host, Eric Skoll. Eric, how are you doing?
Great, Chad. Thank you for having me on. Obviously, this monumental episode of the Cinescope. I've really enjoyed approaching this milestone sort of with you with our last couple episodes.
Yes, and we've alluded towards this in the past couple of episodes that the listeners have heard, but this is technically, as far as like recording goes, like episode 101, because we did record this. It was originally intended. We were going to talk about the How to Train Your Dragon trilogy, and we were going to go, as people might expect, in trilogy order, where you would go one and then two and then three, right? And so we recorded the first episode as 98, and something weird happened as Murphy's Law wanted it to be, and we completely lost audio, or we completely lost my audio, to be more accurate. I have yours. So I don't know how it happened. I don't know why it happened, but it happened. And so we restructured a little bit. We decided to not immediately re-record it because, hey, we don't want a canned conversation where we're just going over the same things we talked about the first time. So what this is going to be is sort of a brief recap of what your thoughts going into and coming out of the first How to Train Your Dragon movie were, your first viewing. And then we can sort of talk about how it fits into the trilogy as a whole and what your thoughts are now that you've rewatched it after watching the second and the third film.
Absolutely. And I got to say, you're not a real podcast until you've completely lost an episode.
That's true.
So I don't know if it's happened to you before, but it certainly happened now going into 100. Congratulations on your podcast being real now.
Being real, yes. We've lost an episode. And maybe one day there will be like some sort of miracle and we find that on. I doubt it. It's been a few weeks at this point. It's not going to happen, but you can hope. Anyways, I realized that since we did that first episode that we lost, people have had you on and listened to you the past couple episodes and several episodes before. But do you want to do a quick recap of who you are, where they might know you from, that kind of stuff before we jump in?
Yeah, I have appeared on over 600 or 700 podcast episodes, mostly on the Harry Potter podcast MuggleCast, which is just a few episodes shy of 500. That's how I know everybody. I don't like keep a tally board or anything, but I'm like, it's pretty easy to count when you have a podcast with that many episodes. But it's been going weekly since 2005. Also, I was on a Game of Thrones podcast called Game of Owns when that TV series for HBO was big. I've really just enjoyed geeking out, talking about nerd stuff, and this is easily, I think, my 10th or so appearance on Cinescope, if not more. Do you think more?
I don't know. I could actually look at the website real quick, because you do have a guest page.
I have my own guest page. Well, you got a really cool website, which I'd like to steal and borrow for my new podcast, but also Chad has been on my podcast 3 times now, actually. I have a brand new podcast called Thank You for Spieling, which is more of the same geeky, nerdy stuff, but not a set topic every week. So Chad has been gracious enough to join me as guest on that. And so there's quite a few possibilities as far as where you've heard me from, but it's really been a highlight of my podcasting experience to be a guest on this show and get to talk about the movies we love.
Well, according to the website, you have been on 10, I think, including the first two How to Train Your Dragon episodes we've done, 10 normal episodes, plus one episode of Cinescope Today, where we talked about Little Women, and then the bonus episode, which I actually re-listened to this bonus episode, where we talked about the CW's Frequency TV premiere, which I never watched past the pilot episode.
Oh, me neither. I had such high hopes, and it wasn't even that my hopes weren't met. I got busy or something. Something went weird. Something went awry.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's no skin off my back because it didn't get renewed past the first season anyway, so it's probably for the best that I didn't keep watching.
One of these days, but I'm just going to bias the season one DVD that got released and go for the best. So wait, that explains everything. Chad, this was unlucky number 13 for appearances, and that could be why the original episode we recorded was cursed.
It's very possible. That's some like Viking superstition right there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So now we go into this with renewed hope. I'm also burning sage, by the way, right now. So it's very sagey. So for good luck.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, well, I thought we would start this episode off by sort of talking about what your thoughts going into the first movie were initially, because I think we told the story the first time we did this, and I'm going to try and not reference the first time we did this multiple times, the reason you are talking about this trilogy with me going into this episode is, one, I like talking with you, but two, I had been trying to get you to watch the How to Train Your Dragon trilogy, or at least the first one, for a long time before you were even on the episode.
Yeah.
I had been texting you about it, and we've found that we have pretty similar taste in movies, and we do tend to gravitate towards movies with characters with daddy issues, and this movie is no exception to that. But I had been texting you, and I'd be like, hey, Eric, by the way, I have this on Movies Anywhere, and I can share it with you via Movies Anywhere, and we could even watch it at the same time if we want. Like, I was like, well, isn't this convenient, Eric? You don't even have to buy the movie. And I tried that a little bit, but then it eventually came, okay, here's my idea. 98, 99, 100, How to Train Your Dragon trilogy, are you in? And you're like, yes. And that was the way to get you in. So now I know how to get you to watch pretty much anything. I just have to ask you to record an episode on Cinescope about it.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's actually tried to... Yeah, but I mean, I'm surprised. Like, we talked about Kubo before we talked about How to Train Your Dragon.
Yes.
And Kubo was a good example. I think Kubo softened me up for feature-length animated films. Of course, I've grown up with all the Disney films and a few DreamWorks here and there. Of course, like Shrek, although mainly only the first one for that. But yeah, like talking about animated films as an adult feels way different. So I think that there was that aspect going into talking about this trilogy with you. I know if you like it, you know, because as you say, our interests are very aligned, that I'm probably going to like it or find something about it that I like. And yeah, that worked out. You know, as far as what I thought going into it the first time, I feel like I developed... And this is not unlike Harry Potter. I developed a weird, unfounded bias against the property. Let me be clear, before actually experiencing a single minute of the actual or a page of the property. And it's because my day job in 2008, 2009, 2010, like right into that area, was for Redbox. And I was stocking the DVD machines with movies. And we would always get, because Redbox was very family friendly and featured tons of like kid movies. In fact, the light box that goes next to the Redbox where we advertise all the movies, the bottom three rows out of like eight rows is all kids movies. And we kept getting the How to Train Your Dragon. I don't know what year this is. It might be into like 14, right when the second one was coming out. We kept getting these direct to video How to Train Your Dragon snippets. I don't know if they were episodes of the TV series or whatever. And, you know, it's kind of like the Land Before Time. It's on like what, movie 26 at this point? Like, who cares? I took it to be that the series was like kind of a milking the whatever story it was, you know, whatever story it had must be bad. It's like, if it's a cash cow, it's like, here's the animated series companion. You know, I unfairly assumed that it was not good, which says something about how I feel about the content my company procures for its movie boxes. But no, I mean, I just didn't know, you know, and I assumed that it was possibly kind of for a younger audience. Again, if not bad, just not for me. Nothing about it spoke to me and at my age group or told me that it would be a movie that somebody my age would like. I think that's a real big thing.
I think there was a little bit of a stigma, and there might even still be a little bit of a stigma against DreamWorks animation just in general, especially when compared to
Disney.
It's not Disney, it's not Pixar specifically. And I mean, they had some success going into this movie. They'd had the Shrek films, which had declined over time, but the first two especially were really good. In the early days, you had The Prince of Egypt, which was traditional
animation.
I love The
Prince of Egypt.
And you have Chicken Run, which is now getting a sequel. So, I mean, there were some early DreamWorks pictures that were really well-loved, but in the mid-2000s, not so much necessarily. They had started to get back into a groove with the Kung Fu Panda movies, which the first one came out in 2008. And then the second one came out after this movie did. But I just don't think that a lot of people expected a lot from DreamWorks because, I mean, hey, it's DreamWorks. It's the people who brought you Shrek, and that's pretty much it. And this movie, I think, really caught me off guard, and so did Kung Fu Panda, for the record, as movies that are actually a lot better than I would have thought they would have been just on the surface. So I think maybe I'm not trying to speak for you, but I think that's just maybe just like a subconscious thing in the culture is DreamWorks has never been as good as Pixar. And so maybe you have slightly lower expectations for what they output.
Yeah. And you know, it's not that I flock to every Disney Pixar outing either. In mm-hmm. fact, there's a few that I missed until quite recently in animated films in general. But if I'm looking over, I actually Googled DreamWorks animation films and they have had a ton. I mean, you mentioned Kung Fu Panda, but also The Croods, Madagascar, Shark Tale, B movie I've actually seen, Monsters vs. Aliens, Spirit, the Stallion movie. Just tons that like were in the peripheral, you know, but I didn't know mm-hmm. that I had seen them or knew much about them. But yeah, so in general, I think DreamWorks Animation, for whatever reason, was flying under my radar, period. And then also, I wasn't convinced that there was just any, nobody told me, I didn't have a Chad early on telling me, hey, you got to see this. And then honestly, I think most recently, it was just I've just been busy, so I never got around to watching it. And then Fever Pitch, you were like, episodes 98, 99, 100, got to do it. So we've watched all three of them now. And let me say that this is a completely, entirely solid trilogy. They are an amazing group of films. They contain so much good character stuff and great music and great story. And it's also quite a unique kind of take on some of the things that it tries to do. So this series actually stands out as being one of the greats for me, I think, now, just because of how moving it is and how beautiful it is to watch and how fun it is to experience time and again.
That makes me smile real big. So I'm really glad to hear that.
Well, yeah, because like we recorded the first, we keep talking about it, but a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And last night, you reminded me, it was like, oh, we're going to redo the episode one tomorrow. And I, within a minute, had gone and turned it on. And I was like, okay, great. I'm going to sit and watch this again. And I had no hesitation. And not only that, but I got new things out of it and enjoyed the hell out of it. And I just, this is a movie that, meanwhile, I've got a list on Netflix that's like 1,000 movies long. But I turned on How to Train Your Dragon. I had just seen it a couple weeks ago, but I really wanted to watch it again. And I had no issues. I wasn't bored. I wasn't like, oh, this movie again. Okay, I guess I will because it's Chad. You know, so that says something. I mean, the only time I've watched a movie that regularly again after I watched it was probably like Harry Potter and I was researching for MuggleCast or something. Uh-huh. You know, but it happens very rarely.
Well, is there any way in which you notice that your views on the film evolved since the first time you watch it, now that you've got the whole trilogy under your belt?
Well, I hugged Stoic. Every minute that he was on screen, I was sort of caressing and hugging my TV screen because I know he's not long for this world. I wanted to make that joke. What was the question?
Is there any way in which you noticed that your views or something, an opinion you had, changed now that you've rewatched it with the trilogy under your belt?
Yeah, you know, I'm interested because I realize how much more alone Hiccup is. In really the sort of the film, I guess the first time we watched it, I assumed that he was going to, you know, get along with his peers eventually and that kind of thing. And when it happened, great. But he really spends most of this film. It's really not until he develops such a strong bond with Toothless that he's able to let others in to see him. I don't know. It's he connects with Toothless first, and it's such a strong bond. And when he can share that, it's not that he meets his fellow Viking friends where they're at. It's that they meet him where he's at. Mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting way of doing character development. Like, you know, lone chief's son who has to eventually one day rule these people. That's a very weird way of doing Hiccup getting to know his classmates, is for him to just find something that he loves so strongly and then to have them be like, hey, this thing that you love is actually pretty cool.
I like that. I think you're right in that forming that bond with Toothless gives him confidence that he didn't have. And yeah. Confidence is noticeable. Like, people pick up on how you feel about yourself. And
yeah.
Even if he's not trying to necessarily buddy up with the other Vikings, I mean, he does a little bit at the beginning of the movie, but something that stood out as you were just talking about him being so lonely was the scene where he gets to the Dragon Book and they're eating dinner together. And Fishlegs is excited about how he's already read it several times. And the Rough Nut and Toughner are like, well, there was a chance I was going to read it, but not anymore. And so they and Snotlout walk off, and Hiccup says, oh, well, to Astrid, it's just you and me now. And she says, nope, it's just you. I've already read it. And so he's just left alone right there in the hall by himself and big empty space, big table, big book all to himself. But when he starts to show his confidence in his ability, even if it's not Viking confidence, it's not killing dragons confidence, it's confidence in himself, confidence in what he's able to do, confidence in approaching these dragons now that he has some inside knowledge that the others don't have, and people are gravitated to that kind of confidence, and that's how he starts to form those better relationships with them.
It's really perfect, the contrivance of the plot of Toothless needs a prosthetic applied to him, and it's something to be forged, and that's exactly what Hiccup does, is he works in the forge, and it's like, I can do this, I can get this, I am the guy that, they complement each other so perfectly, it's almost too perfect, but it's not a criticism. I'm saying, here's an opportunity for these two beings that would ordinarily not, their lives would not intersect except in violence, to really build really a relationship nothing like this world has ever seen before.
I had something in my notes that I just wanted to ask, because I had saved it in my notes from the first time we talked about this. There's a quote toward, I think it's at the beginning of the movie, where Stoic is asking, are there any Night Furies? And we know after watching the third film that all the Night Furies were wiped out. So that made me ask preemptively, do you think that the Night Furies being wiped out was a pretty recent event? Or do you think that it was possible that Toothless was just so, the word I used was effective, that they thought there were more than one?
I like that possibility. I took notes too, and that was the second thing I wrote down. Uh-huh. So I guess any Night Furies. It is completely different from the story of How to Train Your Dragon 3. In How to Train Your Dragon 3, Grimmel has gone to the lengths of the earth to wipe out all of the Night Furies. Again, there's questions about how he did it, how he can be so confident, that sort of a thing. Uh-huh. But it's way different because we are told, like, flat out, nobody's ever seen one and survived. So it's clear that the folks of Burk don't know what Grimmel's up to, that Grimmel is the reason there are so few Night Furies, if we want to incorporate that. But there's actually a quote later where somebody flat out says, no one has ever killed a Night Fury. Mm. And I get the sense that Grimmel, obviously, if he were even an apple in the writer's minds, Grimmel's the kind of character who would kind of boast about that. Like, oh yeah, I'm out here hunting Night Furies, or I'm going to be the best there ever was and kill all the Night Furies. Like, people would have heard of him generally. So, you know, I chalk that up to just the widening of the world that is so necessary for the sequels. It is actually a contradictory statement, I think. So I think that it's mostly that the Night Fury was, in the scope of the first film, supposed to represent the scariest top dragon to raise the stakes of what it was that Hiccup was trying to do in befriending him.
Right.
But the reason I'm okay with this sort of discrepancy is that they continue to push the Night Fury as being the best. Like, he's an instant alpha. So in the second one, when it gets into that, it's like, oh, he's, you know, now the king of all dragons. Toothless being rare doesn't hurt Toothless. And it also, they don't rely on him being so rare for, like, they don't need, because there's enough interesting stuff going with the other dragons. So I don't know. They managed to keep it interesting in each of the films.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could say that the fact that he is alone is another way in which he and Hiccup are so similar. Right. And why they gravitate and why they sort of complete each other and why they needed each other for so long. So yeah, it was just a thought I had, and something else, I don't know if you picked up on it, but every single time they say Night Fury in the first film, somebody else says, get down. So next time you watch, that'll be your own little Easter egg, because it's always Night Fury, get down. Every single time.
Oh,
every single time.
God, I swear, I heard it once where it was like a fake out, and isn't it the Craig Ferguson character says it?
Gobber, yeah.
Yeah, Gobber, but I did not, oh my God, I gotta look at that, yeah, I'm definitely gonna, every time?
Every time it said in public, yes, and that includes the cage scene with the monstrous nightmare, where things go wrong, mm-hmm. And then also at the very end of the movie, after Hiccup wakes up with his prosthetic and they walk out, and Toothless comes out and he's excited to finally go fly again, and somebody says, Night Fury, get down. It's funny the whole time, every single time.
I love that, and that's kind of an interesting thing. Like, you know, you can convey it in dialogue and all that, but these Vikings have grown up knowing that the dragons were bad, and they have a real... They have to turn on a dime then, mm-hmm. when reality proves itself to be otherwise. And so they're capable of weathering some really radical change in a short amount of time. But you love to see it because it's born out of sort of excitement and zest for figuring out what life is really about.
So looking at Hiccup's arc from this film and then looking at his arc across the trilogy, is there anything that stands out about him to you?
He's really consistent throughout, but I like, as you say, his added confidence. One thing that kind of blew me away, again, is it Gobber?
Uh-huh.
Gobber says to Hiccup earlier in the first film, he says, stop trying to be someone you're not. Basically shed that shell and just be more you. And Hiccup does that. That's what Hiccup does. And he has the right circumstances to do that. But for the most part, even though he doesn't have a great deal of confidence even going into the second film, he's consistently surrounded by people who are encouraging him to be him. And that goes into the third film. So for Hiccup, it's really, I want to say I'm jealous, but it's nice that he's got the cushion of communal support, because even before everyone in the village liked him, he still had people like Gobber saying, you know, be yourself, and there's something valuable in that. I mean, Stoic even kind of flips out on Hiccup and does he flat out say, I wish you weren't my son? I think there's something
like
that.
It's the scene after the cage fight, and he says,
you're not my son.
Exactly that.
Yeah, I quoted it. Yeah. So he doesn't get a lot of praise for being himself, and it's not always easy to be yourself, but he could have been taking a dragon's life and decided that that wasn't for him. And I know Astrid asks him, like, couldn't? Wouldn't? You said couldn't. You said wouldn't.
Right.
But he ultimately is deciding to do what feels best to him, and that's no easy feat. So I just appreciate a hero who isn't moved by peer pressure or, you know, is a little bit more in tune with his own feelings on such things.
I'm glad you pointed out how supportive Gobber was in this movie particularly, because he was almost more of a father initially than Stoic was, because Stoic, as we talked about in the course of our discussion, was Stoic was more focused on the village. He was focused on being a good chief, and because Hiccup didn't stand up to the picture of what he thought a Viking should be, it wasn't necessarily his priority to be the father to Hiccup too. He loved his son, there's no doubt about that, but his focus was on feeding the village, protecting the village from dragon, and preemptively going out to stop the dragons to keep them safe in the future. But Gobber, from the beginning, he has that quote towards Hiccup where he says, stop trying so hard to be something you're not. And he just says, I'm just trying to be one of you guys. And Stoic, at the beginning, there's that recurring quote through the whole film where it's like, you just gestured to all of me.
Yeah.
Stop being all of you. There's a lot of people who are not in Hiccup's corner, but Gobber from the beginning always is, even if he sort of jabs at him sometimes. But he's the one who convinces Stoic to put Hiccup into dragon training. Stoic says Hiccup would die before the first dragon left the cage in dragon training. And Gobber says, you don't know that that would happen.
Right.
So from the beginning, even before Hiccup has proven himself in any capacity as capable of being not even in combat, but being around a dragon safely, we saw the disaster of the opening sequence. Gobber was striking confidence in him.
Yeah. And going to bat on Hiccup's behalf to Stoic.
Mm-hmm.
I think the subsequent films kind of make Stoic a more sympathetic character. That's the other thing that was a huge takeaway for me rewatching one, especially with the flashbacks in three that show Stoic, you know, so madly in love with Valka and not willing to replace her. And this is possibly before Hiccup embarrassed everybody a couple hundred more times by being more like him, that Stoic's very like holding him and comforting him and wanting to be around him. And as you say, by the time of the first movie, he's focused on other things than being a parent. So I get it. But yeah, the subsequent films have made him more sympathetic. Yeah, in this film, I was reminded kind of just how harsh Stoic can get. Mm-hmm. That relationship is very strenuous, and it really doesn't let up until it's almost too late. Like, Stoic does not admit that he's wrong until he does, but he doubles down on so much worse. Like, he literally hiccups in love with Toothless. He's found this relationship that means everything in the world to him, and Stoic just takes it away, then straps Toothless up to the mast of a ship and is going to use him as a guide to get to the nest. It's like, you've just taken your son's best friend in the whole world and imprisoned them, and you're going to basically treat them like a slave to achieve your own ends. That's a little bit extra, right? Like, that's, he's really at that point not listening to Hiccup, and it's excused as being, oh, this is, you know, Hiccup's last strike, and everywhere he got in the dragon pit was due to trickery and all this other stuff, these excuses. But none of it holds any water when you think that this is supposed to be a real human relationship between father and son here, and the dad is making no pains to hear or understand, or I don't know. It's just, he doesn't really seem to have an explanation for how and why Hiccup keeps not dying when he's around this Night Fury. he's just distracted. He doesn't care. Mm-hmm. And I found it admirable the first time that I watched how quickly he admits that he's wrong, but it comes quite late. The other thing is that when he does admit that he was wrong, it's for all time, mm-hmm. right? So he has to be shown that it's different. I think it is a commentary on sort of how stubborn, how people can be set in their ways. I mean, we're talking about a culture spanning back at least seven generations. We're talking about traditions. We're talking about even the literature they've read, kill on sight, kill on sight, kill on sight. Right. For dragons, I understand that it may seem a little weird if somebody comes up to you and starts telling you to your face that something is different. So yeah, I just have weird mixed feelings about sort of how stubborn everyone was, and then how immediately, like, once the switch flips, it does flip for good.
Right. That was something I was going to highlight. I mean, even in Hiccup's first opening monologue during the opening sequence of the film, he says, "We're Vikings. We have stubbornness issues." And you see more of Stoic's stubbornness in this movie, and I think you see more of Hiccup's stubbornness, especially in the next movie. Mm. And it shows how alike they are, even if one is more brains than brawn and the other vice versa. But I especially love the journey that Stoic goes on in this movie, because you're right, he's super stubborn. He goes pretty far in not tearing Hiccup down, but distancing himself from him when he says, "You've thrown your lot in with them, and you're not a Viking, you're not my son." And when he says, "You're not my son," his voice breaks. This isn't a conversation he wants to have. He loved his son. He loves his son. But what he sees here, he saw the affiliation with Toothless to be like an ultimate betrayal of his people. They've had seven generations living on this island, and they've been fighting dragons probably the whole time. And so, especially when we see in the second movie, he lost his wife to a dragon, or at least that's the viewpoint that he has. And so that "you're not my son," yes, it's a terrible thing for a father to say to a son, but from his perspective as a chief and as the protector of his people, and knowing what heartbreak the dragons have brought to them up to this point, at least from his perspective, I understand it, and I hurt for him. I hurt for him. I hurt for Hiccup too, but I hurt for Stoic. And as you said, when it gets to the fight, and they crack open the mountain and the green death comes out, and he says, "Odin, help us." Like, he realizes how big a mistake he made immediately. And his first focus, as always, is to protect his people. He says, "I'm going to make a distraction." He tells Gobber to get the people to the boats, get them off, get them away. "I'm going to do what I can to keep the dragon away for as long as possible." So he always has the sacrificial mindset for his people. And then when Toothless, when Hiccup does show up, and he and Gobber are staring up at the sky, this is the first time they've ever seen somebody fly a dragon before. Like, it's the first time. And he immediately, the first chance he gets when he comes face to face with his son, says, "I'm sorry for everything." And he says, "You don't have to do this. You don't have to put yourself out there. You don't have to risk your life to prove a point, if that's what you're trying to do, to show you're brave like me, if that's what you're trying to do. Be my son. You are my son. I'm sorry I said what I said before." And that's all shared in that moment where he he has that face to face with Hiccup. And I love that, like you said, it is for all time. It is showing his faith in his son and showing his love for his son and wanting his son to continue living as you would hope a father would.
Yeah, very much so. And it doesn't help that, you know, I mean, Hiccup himself really threw down his shield and said, it's okay, I'm not one of them. Straight in front of everyone, like in front of the entire town, told the dragon he's not one of them, but also told the Vikings that. And that's a pretty big, you know, repudiation. That's a pretty big FU to Viking culture.
Well, especially when you consider that the helmet that he throws away was an heirloom from his mother.
The boob helmet. Yeah.
The boob helmet. But
which I don't know that holds up consistently. The cup size is not the same as breast sizes in that?
I don't disagree. But okay. that scene is mirrored when Hiccup is lying next to Toothless, possibly dead. After the crash, after the Green Death has been killed, and when he leans down to his son to try and listen for a heartbeat, he tosses aside his helmet. And I love that mirroring where...
You're really good with mirroring scenes in this trilogy.
Especially
like,
in this
it's
trilogy,
like you
yes.
took a college course on him. Yeah. Yeah. I've never noticed like just how many there were. And yeah, that definitely seems to be a strong suit of yours.
Yeah. I love that. It's a small moment and... It maybe doesn't mean as much in that moment when Hiccup tosses his away, but it's a thought where it's more important than how Viking or not he is or what helmet he's wearing. It's, this is my son. Is he alive? Please God, or please Odin, let him be alive. One other thing that I wanted to talk about, at least as far as characters go, is the growth of what we talked about, Hiccup's growth from less confident to more confident, and how people are sort of gravitated to that. But I wanted to focus more specifically on how Astrid and the others, well, Astrid less so than the others, to be honest, gravitate towards Hiccup as he does show his prowess with wrangling the dragons in the training arena. It's a pretty stark contrast.
I feel, and I love Astrid as a character, and I definitely sort of focused in on her a lot during my rewatch of this movie just last night. So I feel confident to talk about this. but yeah, she is kind of like, I wanted to say Hermione Granger. She's not Hermione Granger, but she is somebody who, for whom rules matter, and she was going to be the victor of this dragon training, right? So if Hiccup was not in the picture, she was going to be the next, you know, prize daughter of all of Berk. Uh-huh. And it's because she worked hard to get where she was. The quality that I ascribe to Hermione that I'm giving to Astrid, that I see in Astrid, is this whole, I am doing everything right, so I should be rewarded for it. Like, I'm on the side of good. I've studied, I can train. And she gets a little indignant when it seems that Hiccup is cheating, or he's able to achieve better results than her, and it's because he has more practical experience, right? It's not that Astrid is book smart and is removed from actual physical stuff, but you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hiccup really does have that extra sense, and so it's unfair to her, and she gets, I think, a little indignant, and I think she has every right to. Like, I'm on Astrid's side almost throughout all of it's like, if we didn't have the scenes of Hiccup going off and meeting Toothless and bonding with Toothless and getting all that, it would seem that the fix is in. You'd be like, what the hell is this? Who's this Hiccup chump who's coming in, not studying, not reading the book, you know, not knowing anything about these dragons that is taught, not listening, not paying attention in class. And so with Astrid, she actually, and I agree, I think that she's even a little bit more removed from the others, even as they flock to Hiccup. With his special knowledge, I think she stays a little bit more removed. But she's also been tasked with keeping the secret, because at that point she's met Toothless and she knows that there is a Night Fury, and she knows that. So I think that she is put in a really interesting place by Hiccup, that when he wins her over, she's still kind of cast out a little bit more because she's protecting Hiccup's secret. She can't be his friend, she has to be his confidant. Does that make sense?
It does. the scene that I was thinking of while you were talking just now was, it's probably the second or third training sequence when they're in the maze and they're trying to avoid the deadly natter, which eventually becomes her dragon, by the way. But when Hiccup is asking Gobber about the Night Furies, rather than paying attention to the task at hand.
Yeah.
And that scene ends with Astrid falling on top of Hiccup, her axe getting stuck in his shield, and her barely grabbing that axe and swinging it to deflect the natter before it gets either of them. And she shouts at him and says, "Our parents' war is about to become ours. Decide which side you're on." So Astrid was in for the sport of it, I think, in some aspects, but really she's just trying to continue the legacy of what Vikings on Burk have done for seven generations now.
Right.
Vikings on Burk, they fight dragons. That's what they do. And so she'd been training a long time to be able to do this. She'd shown her prowess in the ring and how physically capable she is to do something like that. And so I also absolutely agree and sympathize with her when all of a sudden Hiccup is showing her up and is able to take out these dragons without swinging an axe, without doing anything physically violent.
The devastating old lady vote that goes to Hiccup instead of Astrid. Like, come on. Like, you know, this is your neighbor and she just kind of said that you were not
right. So
she asks Hiccup, "Is this some kind of a joke to you?"
Right, exactly.
Right when that all happens. And she's indignant about it. And I think that's right. And she carries a weight that I think in Hiccup is very understated. Which is, he sees a way out. He sees a way to write a new world or write a new page in the book. And she doesn't. And so, of course, she's going to react like that. You have to kind of take this stuff seriously because it is a matter of life and death and it is a matter of you or them. So, yeah, I don't fault her at all for not realizing that there's more to the world because she has no reason to. She has not had the experiences in the forest that Hiccup has. So, yeah, I quite like Astrid and I like what she does for this film and the two moments where I think she just like walks up and kisses Hiccup, you know, are both kind of, I don't know, is a part of her character maybe to be a little bit affectionate. I'm not sure on that, but I'm trying to decide if that really fits the rest of her character, but I'm cool with saying that it does.
Well, the first one is after the whole romantic flight sequence where it's basically they're a whole new world. And I mean, yeah. the possibilities have been open.
Was that romantic or are we inflecting a whole new world on it? Like, because I don't think it's functional. I don't know that it's romantic. It's romantic in the way that humans and nature, you know, you're seeing more of like you're connecting to nature in a really primal way, which I guess is romantic. But doesn't she kiss him just for like changing her mind or something?
Possibly.
Well, she's like, "You're right."
Yes, but I mean, I used the title of the song that plays during that sequence, which is called Romantic Flight.
Well, there you go. Who are we to argue with the composer of How to Train Your Dragon?
I mean, it's clear from the beginning of the film. There's that opening sequence when he's introducing us to the side cast of characters, and it gets to Astrid, and the music swells, and he goes, "And Astrid."
Oh, my God.
And the music swells. Yeah. That's the first time we hear that music. And the next time we hear that is when they do go on that A Whole New World sequence together. And so I think maybe that initial kiss was just like thank you for showing me that there is more to what I thought the world was. And in that way, she's sort of a precursor to Stoics' eventual transformation, is there are these people who believe so strongly in their role in protecting their people from dragons who can be convinced that killing dragons is not the only solution.
Yeah.
And then talking about the other characters, we see them one over earlier, but when it comes to the time when they have to go pursue Stoic and the rest of the village in order to save them, there is no hesitation from those friends in following Hiccup in whatever his plan is. They've never been in a situation where they are interacting with dragons in this way. They've never even considered flying one of them.
Yeah.
But when Hiccup takes Snotlout's hand and outstretches it towards the monstrous nightmare, the one that lights itself on fire, I mean, I can understand some trepidation and he's maybe a little bit nervous at first, but it's not like he completely fights Hiccup on it and he warms up to it pretty quickly. And when they fly up on the island, I think it's also Snotlout who says, "Look at us, we're on dragons, all of us. Look," they're so excited to see, these are the first people to fly dragons in the first, like, ever. well, not ever, in Berk, I should say, because we do learn that there are some other dragon riders, or at least there's like Valka and presumably more out there who came in the times before Hiccup in other places.
Yeah.
But something interesting that I had considered was all the Vikings probably flew dragons back to Berk, didn't they?
Yeah.
Because the fleet was completely wiped out.
Well, damn, you can pick your pet right from right at the nest.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And we see in that moment when Stoic is cheering that Toothless has saved Hiccup, and he says, thank you for bringing me my son, as all the Vikings stand on the edge and they stare in and they're cheering too. You see the dragons come up over their shoulders and it's like, oh, we're friends now. And they've been freed. They've been freed from oppression in some respect. And so, yeah, that was something I didn't really even consider until the last time I watched this to first record this episode was, yeah, all these guys probably flew dragons for the first time that day. Pretty cool.
The comfort that I take is that all of this dragon training wasn't for nothing now that they are no longer training to kill dragons. Because the thing that I keep thinking about is in Ender's Game, the sort of philosophy that Ender really takes to heart is that in order to defeat my enemy, I must know him. Uh-huh. But in knowing him, I also love him.
Yes, I remember that from that book.
Yeah, so if you know somebody so completely, you love them. And I think that in the aspect, it works and ports over to the children in this movie, because they've studied these dragons, they know their sort of weaknesses, but rather than needing to use that to kill them, now that they're allies with these dragons and friends, they are better equipped to sort of move with them in battle, right? And I think the dragons all, to a person, know exactly what a human's weaknesses are. They can get burnt very easily. Is it the second film that shows dragonhide armor, or is that the third one
where they start to make dragonhide armor?
That was a long time coming, actually. You'd think they would have figured that out sooner. But yeah, so my point is they can move together better now that they've studied them. And I think that's sort of the buy-in for Fishlegs and Snotlout and all of them, is like, we've seen these dragons up close, but now let's like do something that no one's ever done, and let's get to know them even better, because they have been studying them. And so they're not so much focused on the killing of the dragons if it means that they will learn something new. I don't know. They're kind of more interested in the education aspect of it than the killing, I think, which is always makes for a good movie.
I wanted to ask about Stoic and Toothless's relationship, especially knowing what happens in the second film.
If you ever get me to rewatch the second film, I'll have more interesting thoughts on it. But yeah, it's totally crazy. Really just the brutish manipulation of Toothless by Stoic when he's going to use him to get to the nest. The fact that it actually works, but then it is, of course, Stoic that saves Toothless from drowning, presumably, mm-hmm. if dragons drown. And there's a real understanding there. Not quite the love and understanding that Hiccup and Toothless have, but thanking him for bringing his son back alive is very, 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 like, you couldn't get a more sincere, like, showing of gratitude than what Stoic has for Toothless. So I really liked it. I think that Stoic and Toothless are never going to see eye to eye the way Hiccup and Toothless do. That's by design. But I think that there's a respect for a creature. And if you think about it, Stoic probably, there's so few dragons that he's ever respected. Uh-huh. And he's just today learned that dragons aren't all to kill. So I think it's a huge move, a huge gesture for Stoic to kind of treat Toothless immediately with the kind of sentience that Hiccup is begging him to see.
Yeah, there are three specific interactions in this movie that I wanted to point out. Okay. The first is in the cage. When Hiccup is, goodness, I've done it so many times, even in this episode, where I switched the names, where Toothless is charging and he's ready to kill. He is going to take down Stoic. Possibly he's seen this creature in previous encounters with the other dragons and how ruthless he's been towards dragon kind. And he's not ready to hold back, but he does, because Hiccup stops him. And he immediately becomes completely docile. Like, oh, okay, he's not a bad guy. Cool, I trust you. Then Stoic does exploit that, and they do lock up Toothless, and they do use him.
Yeah.
But that's the first interaction, is that Toothless is stopped from killing Stoic in that moment. And that's one of my staying points when it comes to the second movie. And there's the question, would Hiccup have been able to stop Toothless from killing Stoic had he been given the chance? Possibly. I would like to think so, just because of that connection, but we unfortunately do not get to see that. But the other two interactions in this movie, the first one is that one you mentioned where Hiccup has arrived, the boat has been hit, and Toothless is still locked up and is going to drown. And so Stoic dives down after he saves Hiccup and tosses him aside. And There's no hesitation. Okay, I've saved my son. Now I've got to save my son's dragon so that he can do what he needs to do. And so he dives down and he comes face to face with Toothless. And obviously they're underwater. There's not a word said, but they stare at each other. And there's this understanding between the two of them. And one's not going to fight the other anymore. I think they both understand that in that moment. And Toothless allows him to save him without any resistance. And then the last one is when Toothless has saved Hiccup after the fire, and Stoic places his hand on Toothless and says, "Thank you for bringing me my son." I think those three moments show a huge amount of growth between both of those characters. I love that Stoic is able to see the importance that Toothless has in Hiccup's life and the control that Hiccup is able to exert over Toothless in some respects. And maybe he even recognizes that I could have been killed by this creature earlier and he showed me some mercy. And maybe I didn't show him that same mercy to begin with, but it's time I do. I think that's really special.
I agree. And it's nice to see, you know, with the bigger picture being that the dragons in the first film are so oppressed by the big dragon, that they're sort of mutually free, that the paths cross, and now at this point in time, dragons and humans can finally get along. Like, you know, if we just weren't enemies, what if we were friends? That's such an interesting question to ask. I think that was probably one of the more heavy-handed sort of takeaways you're supposed to take away, is the people who you thought your enemies, like, after all this time, could actually just quite easily be your friends. A very interesting sort of main moral.
Was there anything else in regards to this film or in regards to the trilogy that you wanted to talk about?
I think the reasons why we love this trilogy, you know, and I think definitely why I called it one of the greats, it really deals with community in a really interesting way. All of the side characters, it's weird because they're a lot alike in a lot of ways. It's, you know, I've never seen Madagascar, so I shouldn't compare it. But you know how you got, like, the fox and the penguin and the... I'm not going to do it.
I was about to say, I don't remember there being a fox in Madagascar, but there's a lion.
I'm thinking Over the Hedge. Yeah, anyway. It's like, instead of it being where there's, like, a lion and a fox and a penguin, and the penguin's going to make penguin jokes, and the chipmunk's going to make chipmunk jokes, and all that stuff. They're all just humans, and they're all like neighbors, and they're all from the same village. And that's very interesting, I think. They're all incredibly different for as much as they are similar. I can't name another film that has just a group of children. Oh, wait, probably Harry Potter. But yeah, I don't know. It's the communal aspect of it, the fact that Hiccup is a chief after the events of 2 and really has to look after his people, how we shoulder responsibility, the struggle between what we want to do and what we feel is right and what we're told to do and what we know might be wrong, but that which society expects. All of these themes are in there to be taken out by a viewer, and any viewer can get a lot out of watching these films. Like, I got more out of watching these films than I was expecting, like tons more.
I'm really glad to hear that. I really like the idea that this movie is showing us that you can be alike and different at the same time and not lose your individuality, but not lose your sense of community and friendship and relationship with others. This movie redefines for the people of Berk what exactly a Viking is. Viking doesn't necessarily mean stoic, big, and brawn. It could mean, in some aspects, Hiccup, small, scrawny, but smart and resourceful and kind. And I think that to find that mutual ground between those two extremes is what a community sort of needs to do in any community, whether it's real world, whether it's another fictional world, but especially here in Berk, they realize that Viking is what they make it to be. That's like the corniest quote I've ever said in my life, but it's true. Viking doesn't mean one thing. Viking, they are all Vikings. There isn't a set definition, and they have to just sort of let go of the way they thought things always were and be open to things that could be. And I think that's something that this movie in particular opens up, and we see that further explored in 2 and 3.
Yeah. I mean, I think the bookend of the film of this is Burke, which goes on in at least the second one I remember too. In the beginning of the first film, just re-listening to it, he says, what is Burke? In a word, sturdy.
Right.
but he's also, it's almost disdainfully, he's like, sturdy. He's not happy about it. It's not a good quality necessarily. It's like, we're cold, you know, this is not going to be received well. He says stubborn. It's a bit sturdy. And I'm like, but that can mean so many things, though. And watching Hiccup gradually come to love the place that he lives as it grows to accept and love him is pure crack cocaine heroin for anyone who's ever felt isolated from a community and who's felt like they didn't belong. You know, Hiccup's journey is very inspiring in that way, if you identify with him and his struggles, because it is ultimately about people finding and being the best version of themselves, or if you're a villain, sticking to your guns, I guess, until you're being proven wrong either kills you or you have to regret it and turn around. Yeah, I don't know, but I had an idea there.
There's a quote that I just found from the third film, and it's from one of the flashbacks with Stoic, and he says, with love comes loss, son. It's part of the deal. Sometimes it hurts, but in the end, it's all worth it. There's no greater gift than love. And I love seeing across the trilogy these characters who continually sacrifice for each other and for their dragons and for their people. And it's modeled in this film by Stoic. It's ultimately modeled by Stoic in the second film. And then Hiccup does the same thing, following in his father's footsteps, when we get to the end of the third film. And maybe it's not like he does ultimately sacrifice his life, but he just happens to make it out alive, even if that wasn't his expectation. And so I love seeing that outlook, that ideal modeled by Stoic and then echoed by his son later, because we even see it from Valka in 2 and 3, children learn from their parents. And whether that's always a good thing or sometimes a bad thing, that is always up for question. But in these movies, we see how Hiccup is a product of his parents, and he learns from them and takes advice from them and is not the annoying teenager who doesn't listen to his parents or is not open to changing because of something his parents say. Yeah, he fights them a couple times, especially in like the second one. He's stubborn about wanting to be chief when his father is ready for him to take on that responsibility, but he comes around. And I think that's something we've talked about. That's something that's Hiccup's journey in this trilogy, is realizing his place in Burke and his place as leader of Burke and the place dragons have in their lives for a time, but then the time when the dragons need to go away. There's so much of Stoic in Hiccup by the time we get to the end of the trilogy, and I love seeing that kind of growth.
Very well said.
So any other final closing thoughts?
I think I opened, when we were first discussing the first film, I might have opened with this remark, but dragons are cats, right?
Yeah, they're basically cats. I've got my black dragon sitting right next to me.
Dragons in this world are cats. And that will never not be amusing to me. And anyone who's ever owned a cat, like Toothless, 100% grade A. In this film, most of all, I think, to eat everything, spitting up the food. I mean, that's kind of like baby burning, but like, I just... If cats were just a little bit more emotive, they would be toothless. Like, they would absolutely 100%. The sounds, the movement, the way they slink, their distrust, the growl is, you know, it's just, it, all of it is very inspired. The idea that they decided, like, the designers were like, yeah, we're going to base dragons on cats is such a unique choice that I think said, but it's a through line. They totally, you know, maintained that kind of behavior and that imagery and that understanding of how the dragons in this world work. Oh, it's like cats. Mm-hmm. It's just so interesting because cats are very much not the most friendly pets that we could possibly have in the world. There are always dogs, but it's cats. And so I really admire that choice. It nourishes me. It makes me laugh so much every time I see a connection.
It's a great way for us as people to endear ourselves to the dragons in these movies is to identify them with our pets. I think Toothless and like the Light Fury in the third movie especially are very cat-like. I think the Gronkle maybe is a little bit more of a dog.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I wonder if these movies are bigger hits among cat people versus dog people.
Oh, that's a good thought.
That would be a good like thought experiment to do, or like actual hard science data.
I don't know how to go about that, but maybe we can come up with something.
We'll figure it out.
Okay, well, thank you once again, Eric, for going on this journey with me. I'm so glad to have gotten you to watch finally, and not just that you watched it, but that you enjoyed it. And now that we've talked in excess of 3 or 4 hours about this trilogy in total,
yeah,
I am just glad to end this era of Cinescope, 100 episodes. That's crazy. Wow. On movies that mean so much to me, and to be talking about them with you. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
It was completely my pleasure. And to any of the listeners who've listened to the most recent couple of episodes, thanks for powering through. Hopefully you got as much out of it and like the movie as much as we do. But it's certainly been really, really fun to go on this journey and see these movies. And yeah, thanks for making it possible. Thanks for making it happen.
For our 100th episode, it would be super fantastic if everybody went to Apple Podcasts and left a review if you haven't already, or if you have, or if you don't have Apple Podcasts, like you're an Android user, I suppose, just share an episode with friends on social media. That's a great way to help introduce it to new people and start to grow the audience. I would be super thankful, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on the show in general. So 100 episodes. That would be an awesome thing for you to do. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Cinescope Pod. You can go to the website, The Cinescope Podcast, to see all of the show notes. And Eric, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Spielerman, Spielerman. My new podcast, Thank You for Spieling, is TYF Spiels on Twitter. I'll make it short this time. But that's just, find me on Twitter. That's where I live.
Same. So you can find me on Twitter also at Chadadada. That is my personal account, Chadadada. And there's my other podcasts, which are An American Workplace, where we talk about every episode of The Office. And then there's also Crossroads of Destiny, where we're talking about Avatar, The Last Airbender, one episode at a time. And I'd love if you listen to those as well. But 100 episodes of Cinescope, yay. Super excited to still be doing the show. And let's have a lot of fun going into 2021, everybody. Thank you for listening. Have fun and celebrate movies.